Call this meeting the Judiciary Committee to order. Members, take your seats. A quorum is present. Today, we're hearing three bills. House File 3274, laid over from last time. Another bill from Representative Adelson, House File 2898, and House File 3391, Representative Mahler. But first, we got the minutes from February 27th. Okay, Representative Considine moves the minutes of February 27th. Any discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. The minutes of February 27th are approved. So first, Common Interest Ownership Act. Representative Carlson, would you like to move that House File 3274 be recommended to be placed on the general register?
Yes, Chair, that is my motion.
And the bill is before us, and go ahead, tell us about your bill, Representative Carlson.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair, members. This bill creates a court approval process for proposed amendments to associations' governing documents. By associations, we're talking condo associations and townhomes. This bipartisan bill was brought to me by the Community Association Institute and my constituent, Patty Fisk, who is to my right. Patty is the president of the Old Shakopee Park North Homeowners Association in Bloomington. Like all association boards, Patsy volunteers her time, and she's doing extra duty today to be with us here to testify on behalf of this bill. Homeowners associations, also referred to as common interest communities, are nonprofit corporations and are governed by certain documents, including articles of incorporation, bylaws, and declarations. The declaration sets forth the rights and responsibilities of the owners, residents, and board of directors for each homeowners association. It covers things like who's responsible to repair the roof, plow the parking lot, who parks where, and whether or not you're allowed to have pets. Most importantly, and why we are here today, informs residents on how they can amend their governing documents. Some declarations, like the one for Old Shakopee Park North, requires 80% or even 100% of its unit owners to approve the amendments. So members, as we all know, it's extremely difficult to get 80 to 100% to approve anything. This bill would create a court process that allows the court to approve an amendment with 67% of when 67% of homeowners agree. The association documents that it has properly served notice to its members, and the court holds a publicly notified hearing where all parties are able to be heard. This is a high bar, and it's meant to be. CAI, which is the Community Association Institute, worked through multiple drafts with the Minnesota Common Interest Ownership Act Subcommittee of the Bar Association throughout the interim. The Bar Association has no concerns with the bill. We have also shared the bill with the Realtors Associations, the Bankers Association, Land Title Association, Cooperative Network, Minnesota Association of Justice, and none have objected to the bill. So that is my testimony, and with me today I do have Patsy Fisk, who would like to share her story.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Fisk. Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Chairperson and ladies and gentlemen of the committee. My name is Patsy Fisk. I'm the president of the board at Old Shakopee Park North. Old Shakopee was built in 1978, and that's when our governing documents were created. And the state of Minnesota has made new laws and new rules and regulations since then. But our declaration says we need to have 100% of all the owners agree to any amendments, which of course is really hard to get. We have started the process about a year ago, and I still have two people left. When we first started the process, we got to 67% approval fairly quickly. But since then, I've had to individually talk to all the rest of the people and explain the governing documents to them and ask for their approval. One of the things in our old governing document said that we can't have any kids living in our building. And you know, that's unlawful, that's illegal. So one of the things our new proposed governing documents does is take that clause out of there. So our new governing documents incorporate all the new state rules and regulations and laws and statutes. There's no really big changes except now making us legal. So I really need for you guys to look carefully at this bill and approve it so it can go on to its next step, because 100% is just pretty near impossible. So thank you, sir.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Fisk. I think what we'll do is we'll take other testifiers, and if there are questions for Ms. Fisk or testifiers, we can do those thereafter. Who else do you have for testifiers, Representative Carlson?
I have Patrick. He's my wingman on this.
Mr. Hines? Mr. Hines, do you want to testify, or you just want to?
He's my wingman.
Excellent. He's a resource. Anyone else who wants to testify on House File 3274? Anyone from the audience who wishes to be heard on House File 3274? Questions from members? Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. I'm just interested why you chose a court process rather than arbitration. It seems like the courts already have so much on their plates, and this is relatively a small issue. So why this route?
Yeah, very good question. And I'm going to have Patrick come up to speak to that succinctly. The courts haven't expressed this being to that point, that this wouldn't be a tremendous burden on them due to the volume. So there wasn't a concern in terms of the impact on their workload. But to further explain or to address the question.
Mr. Hines.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Patrick Hines with Messerly and Kramer for the Community Associations Institute. Representative Robbins, one of the reasons when we started looking at this proposal is that we looked to other states, and they had a court process in place, and that is what we started with. And arbitration can be pretty expensive, and a court hearing process in this case we thought was an easier route for the association to go. It would simply be petitioning the court for a hearing, and upon receiving the petition with the required elements, the court would issue a hearing date. The association would be responsible for providing notice to the hearing through the rules of civil procedure, and then really should just be a single hearing, and then the court can issue the order. So I think in this case it's probably more expeditious for the association and the residents to go through the district court process.
Representative Robbins.
Okay. Chair Johnson.
Chair Less. Representative Robbins also had as part of my question, I'm just wondering how many, or does this also include covenants for us? Like, I live in a neighborhood, and land has covenants on what you can do and can't do on your property. Does this also cover that as well?
Mr. Hines?
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, no, this would not cover any sort of covenant that you had that ran with the title to your property. This is only amending the Common Interest Ownership Act, so it only applies to homeowner associations.
Chair Johnson.
Chair Lesh, Representative Carlson. Do you happen to know how many homeowners associations and things this will cover in the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson. There are approximately 7,700 community associations in Minnesota. I do not know how many have old declarations that have these extraordinarily high requirements for amendment. They typically are older associations like Ms. Fisk's, built back in the 60s or 70s. So we don't have a great idea of how many associations have this number, but it's our estimate of how many would actually go through this process is pretty small, maybe a dozen or so.
Chair Johnson.
Chair Lesh, I guess your estimate might also be awfully low. We could have 5,000 after this bill passes. If it's signed into law, that could go into the courts to jam up the court system. So just wanted to be aware that it could have a big impact on our court system.
I don't think so. Any other testimony from anyone else wants to be heard on this? Chair Liebling.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. Does this only apply to homeowner associations or like also to commercial tenant associations? I mean, you know, there are commercial properties where people own the various, you know, office condos and stuff like that.
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, this is limited to residential association.
Thank you.
All right. There being no other testimony and no other questions from committee members or discussion, then Representative Carlson's motion is before us that House File 3274 be recommended to be placed on the general register. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. The bill is passed and placed on the general register. Thank you, Representative Carlson.
Chair.
The next one we have is Representative Edelson, House File 2898. Relating to civil commitment, modifying provisions governing civil commitment. So I will move that House File 2898 be recommended to be re-referred to HHS Finance with Chair Liebling. And Representative Edelson, you have an author's amendment labeled A3. So can I have a motion to place the A3 before us to put the bill in the shape the author so desires? Representative Norm makes the motion. Any discussion? All in favor of the A3 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. The A3 is adopted and the bill is amended. Go ahead, Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Chair, committee members. House File 2898 is culmination of nearly 3 years of work by a large group of stakeholders organized by NAMI Minnesota. This bill has gone through HHS policy and public safety so far. I believe it's routed to HHS finance after this. It included, the stakeholder group included advocacy organizations, police and sheriffs, hospitals association, county attorneys, counties, DHS staff, community providers, psychiatrist, psychologist, a person with a mental illness, and a family member, a lead counsel from the civil commitment public defense. It operated by consensus. So even if one person objected to a change, it was not included. This is to make clear that there were other changes that various groups wanted to make, but we wanted a bill that everyone could live with. The goal was to update the language, reflect that people are generally committed or provisionally discharged to a community, and to provide for early voluntary engagement. We work to make sure people can receive the best medication to treat their illness and that missing paperwork doesn't lead to a commitment going away. There are a couple of things that this bill does not do. It does not change the current commitment standard, so it does not make it easier or harder to commit someone. We don't make any changes to what records are public and not public. Chair, I'd like to move in terms of time to my testifier.
Sure. Ms. Abder-Holden, please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, Sue Abder-Holden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota, and I'll just briefly go through parts of it and then turn it over to John Kerwin. We made a change to the definition of examiner. This is a person who can put on a 72-hour hold by expanding it to all mental health professionals, which should really help in rural Minnesota where you have more licensed marriage and family therapists. We continue to keep a court examiner, though, to physicians, APRNs with mental health background, and psychologists. We changed the definition of interested person to make sure that it's limited to a specific to a person who has a specific interest in the individual. We updated the definition of someone who poses a risk of harm by using people first language. We changed the definition of health officer to also include all mental health professionals and a mental health practitioner who is operating under the supervision of a mental health professional on a mobile mental health crisis team. Under Section 21, we added the power of attorney and health care directive to the section on consent for medical procedure. We also made some clarifications about when you can't obtain consent in time for an emergency situation. Section 23, again, we added healthcare directive. Section 29 is a very new section that was really, frankly, pushed by NAMI. Won't get into all the details, but what we wanted to do was to provide an opportunity for early voluntary engagement. So we don't have to wait, a family doesn't have to wait till someone meets the definition or the criteria for commitment, but we can actually use outreach workers to try to engage that person to treatment voluntarily. We deleted some language on Section 30, but moved it to Section 132. In Section 33, we deleted some language related to health plans. Health plans don't really hold treatment records. There was some really old language in there that no longer made any sense. And then lastly for me, on section 38, under pre-petition screening, we said if possible, an in-person interview is better, but if that can't happen, then it can't happen. And then the notice of any decision would go to anyone in the examiner statement, so that really helps in terms of family members who might be part of that petition, that they get information about what that decision was.
Okay, thank you. And we've got another testifier up here before us. Go ahead, please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Kerwin. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney, and I was a member of the task force that came up with these recommendations. So I'm going to pick up where Ms. Abderholden left off. And so if you look at section 50 of the bill, one of the things that it does is it says that the court in committing a person should look at a range of options for commitment, including assertive community treatment or ACT teams. That section also has a provision that authorizes what we call dual commitments. We started using them, but they've never really been authorized by statute. And that means committing a person to both a community facility and the Commissioner of Human Services as a backup. It kind of recognizes what has changed over the last 20 years and 40 years, which is that most treatment now is provided in the community. There's another change in that section that that changes a limitation on placement under the Commitment Act. One of our bases for committing a person who has a mental illness is if the person is unable to meet their needs. But there was a limitation in that, that they could only be committed to a community facility, not to the state, and that wouldn't allow us to use these dual commitments in those situations. And so that limitation has been removed. In sections 54 and 55, those are the sections dealing with the administration of neuroleptic medications to people who are subject to commitment. There's a provision that adds a power of attorney to the type of advanced directives that can be considered in deciding what the person wants. There's language that says that where the person has been receiving the medications in the community and then is hospitalized, that those medications can be continued not only until someone makes a motion to get a court order, but also until the court issues the order. So that's kind of a technical but needed amendment. There's an amendment that clarifies how the court considers the statutory factors that are listed. They're already listed in the statute, but this says how the court puts them together in making the decision regarding competence. In the section regarding whether the person's refusal of medications is based on his mental illness, the statute now uses the word delusion, and there's a change that's made to make that more broad, the symptoms of the person's mental illness. There's an important change that says that if it's necessary to forcibly administer medications, that that can only be done by injection and not by nasogastric tube. And there's another significant change that says that if there's an existing Jarvis order, that medications can be forcibly administered in a community setting, including a jail, if there's appropriate qualified medical personnel to do that. In section 61, there's a provision that says that if a person is committed to the commissioner but is in a local hospital, that the commitment order is sufficient authority for the local hospital to hold the person until they can be transferred to the state. Section 62 is a provision that deals with reports and so on that are due after a person is committed, and it requires a report within 90 days and a report within 6 months. The current statute says that if those reports aren't filed, the commitment automatically terminates. This changes that so the a needed commitment isn't lost, but that the court will require the report to be submitted within 5 days, and if it isn't, then have a hearing within 2 days. There's a provision in section 66 that says that when it comes time and is necessary to bring a petition to recommit the person, that if that order can't be obtained within the period of time before the previous order expires, that the court can extend it for 14 days for good cause. There are some provisions dealing with provisional discharge. In Section 69, it says that if a person has been committed to the commissioner and is in a community facility that becomes ready for provisional discharge before they ever go to the state, the community facility can simply provisionally discharge the person. And there's a provision that says that if the, and this is in Section 78, if the person needs to be recommitted and they're on provisional discharge at that time, the recommitment order serves as an extension of the provisional discharge. And so I think that ends the sections that we were asked to address in this hearing, and we're available to answer questions.
Thank you, Mr. Kerwin. Chair Considine.
Thank you, Chair Lesh. First, I'd like to say that I'm really pleased that the Jarvis order can be implemented in jails. Oftentimes, my personal experience was is that people would come in, they were in need of their medications, and it bordered on, I thought, torture not to do that because they were struggling. And once they got the medications, then they were eligible to, they would settle down and we could move them on. So really happy about that provision. In the dual diagnose or the dual commitment, did you address the commitment between the Department of Corrections and DHS? That's the ones, again, that I'm more familiar with and frankly always found really troubling if they were eligible for commitment to DHS. Kind of felt like they shouldn't have been committed to Department of Corrections. Was there any discussion about that?
Mr. Kerwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And remember, the, this bill does not address that. It's only in terms of dual commitments. It's only addressing the situation of the community hospital and the commissioner. I'm aware of the other situation you're describing, but this bill doesn't make any changes regarding that.
Thank you. Your work ongoing. I'd like to see that addressed at some point because, again, if they're sufficiently ill to be committed to the DHS, then I don't think corrections should come into play. Thank you.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I did have a question that I'd like to get an answer for on the record, and I spoke to some folks that are working on this on your behalf yesterday outside of House floor. But on page 5, at the very top of the page, 5.1 through 5.3, there's some stricken language there regarding sexual psychopathic personalities, and I'm just wondering why that language is stricken.
Mr. Kerwin.
Mr. Chair and member, the reason that was stricken, it was actually stricken at the suggestion of the reviser, and their particular objection to it was that it was sort of operative language, not definition language, but in a definition, and they thought that was inappropriate. And so the suggestion was to move it elsewhere. And what we did, it was already largely covered in the sexually dangerous person commitment statute, and I do a lot of those commitments myself. That's one of my specialties. And but we looked carefully at the SDP commitment statute, and this bill adds a little bit of language in the SDP statute to make sure that all of the necessary procedures from this law that need to be utilized under that statute are incorporated. And so we made sure that nothing was lost by removing this language.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Is there anyone else from the, I'm sorry, Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I just would like to, I'm very concerned about people's civil liberties, and so a lot of these definitions are broadened for who is an examiner, who is a court examiner, who is a health officer, who is an interested person. So could you just explain a little bit more on the record about your discussions around broadening all of these definitions and how that will, how people's civil liberties will still be protected? Thank you.
Ms. Abderholden?
Mr. Chairman, member. I actually think it's better. You have mental health professionals who, frankly, are more highly trained in the diagnosis and treatment of people with mental illnesses, who I believe will be better able to assess whether someone should be both transported and put on a 72-hour hold. So we think it actually adds protections because we have a higher level of knowledge about mental illnesses.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do see some of those mental health designations, but also you're expanding it to nurse practitioners and people who don't necessarily have a mental health training per se. So could you address that?
Representative Abderhold.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Robbins, actually it's the clinical nurse specialists, APRNs, who have a mental health certification have always been there. So that is not a change. There are discussions with the community about whether if they're in an emergency room, what happens in critical care hospitals is that they don't actually have anyone that meets any of these definitions. So someone's transported there on a 72-hour hold, or, you know, to be on a transport hold, excuse me, and then there's no one there to actually do a 72-hour hold. So there was, I can assure you, a great discussion, and we had, I mean, this was a true balancing act, you know, between people's rights and people's need for treatment. But people actually really felt comfortable having mental health professionals be a piece of this.
Representative Ramos. Okay. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question is probably for Ms. Abderholden. I note on the section 54 where we're talking about the stricken language being put back in with regard to neuroleptic versus psychotropic. And both families of medications deal with behaviors, whether they be manic or schizophrenia. And I'm just wondering why one was chosen and the other one was stricken.
Ms. Abderholden?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Albright. So this was something that kind of blew apart, I guess I would say, last week. We had wanted to make sure that psychotropic medications could also be used in a Jarvis order so that we could address someone with bipolar disorder that needed a mood stabilizer. We had the psychiatrist saying we'd really like to prescribe the right medication for someone. We couldn't quite come to an agreement. We couldn't even come to an agreement on whether to use the word antipsychotic versus neuroleptic. So we decided to, again, because we're trying to operate a consensus, to pull that from the bill at this time. And everyone is committed to continue to work on this over the summer, over the interim, to come back and to try to address that.
Representative Albright? Okay, thanks. Fully answered. Is there anyone else from the audience who wishes to be heard on House File 2898 as amended? Any other comments from the committee? Then seeing none, the motion is before us, put forth by me, that House File 2898, as amended, be recommended be re-referred to the HHS Finance Committee. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Motion passes. The bill does pass and is re-referred to HHS Finance. The next bill up is Representative Mahler, House File 3391. There is a small fiscal note on this. So this is the final bill we have up today, modifying and modernizing certain provisions governing guardianship and conservatorship. Representative Mahler moves that House File 3391 be re-referred to Ways and Means. And we have a DE1 amendment. Representative Mahler, would you like to make the motion for that DE1 amendment to put the
so moved, Mr. Chair.
The DE1 amendment has been moved. Any discussion? All in favor of the DE1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. The DE1 is adopted. And Representative Mahler, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For nearly 2 years, a coalition of attorneys, advocates, guardians, and many other stakeholders gathered to closely examine Minnesota's guardianship and conservatorship laws with the goal of modernizing them. And you'll see in your packet some handouts that have some of those groups that were involved in this bill. This bill incorporates the comprehensive recommendations from that coalition while also building upon many recommendations from the Uniform Law Commission's 2017 updated model guardianship law. This bill seeks to reduce unnecessary guardianships and conservatorships, promote less restrictive alternatives, and clarify multiple parts of the law that conflict with current best practices. More specifically, the bill makes changes to definitions and defines important terms such as supported decision making for the first time. It requires petitions and orders for guardianship to detail why less restrictive alternatives cannot work. It narrows the reasons a guardian can restrict access to visitors. It updates the Guardianship Bill of Rights, clarifies how certain notices must be given, requires time-limited guardianships for people under 30. It provides better safeguards for medical and financial privacy of persons being put through guardianship proceedings. Many of the provisions of this bill are the result of thoughtful debate and compromise from stakeholders who often have different views of the guardianship and conservatorship system, but who all believe these changes will make the system better for thousands of Minnesota. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would like to introduce my testifiers.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Darcy Rossborough. I'm the parent of a 19-year-old son whose name is Eric. He has epilepsy, high-functioning autism, and a number of other diagnoses that keep our life very interesting at all times. I'm privileged to provide testimony in support of this very important bill. Our family first learned about supported decision-making from an attorney that I was consulting about guardianship several years ago. I have been told and reminded many, many times through our healthcare providers, mental health providers, and the school system that I needed to make sure I got guardianship in place for Eric by the time he turned 18. When this attorney described supported decision-making to me, I knew we found a much better fit for our decision, for our situation. As Eric's supporters, we help him make crucial decisions, and we have a process in place to do that. We're not his guardians. When Eric has a decision to make he needs help with, he talks to either myself or his aunts or his uncles that are all part of his supported decision-making team, and we walk through what he's saying, and we make sure that we help him make a good decision. A specific example of this is that Eric was in a post-secondary transition program for ages 18 to 21 this past fall, and it turned out that Eric felt he was ready to go ahead and be done with this program, take his diploma, and move on, and his teachers disagreed with that. Through the supported decision-making process, we had a great conversation about his life goals in general, moving on into an apartment with roommates, getting ready for the organization skills, life skills, and the financial skills that he was going to need to be able to live independently and create a path toward that. With that in mind, he ultimately came to the decision on his own that he was ready to be done with school, acquired his diploma, and finished up. So that we are in great shape with right now. I'm sorry, I didn't get my notes down here. So Eric couldn't be with us here today because luckily he's at work. He's at Devani's this morning, and I asked Eric what he would want to tell you. He uses supported decision-making to help think through decisions, like what jobs to investigate as part of his vocational rehab service program, or whether or not to get his wisdom teeth surgery now or later. He says, because of the supported decision-making, I make my own decisions, which, trust me, is very important to him. We strongly support this bill as it will help others who have this important opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Rossborough. We're going to wait on questions from the committees until we hear other testifiers, too. So thank you. You can stick around for questions. And you have another testifier, Representative Mahler?
Yep, that's correct, Mr. Chair. I've got two testifiers here, and I will let them introduce themselves with your permission.
Welcome. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Mary Hoff. Together with my daughter, Jean, we are privileged to provide testimony in support of this important bill. Our family first learned about supported decision-making from Jonathan Martinez, an expert in disability law issues, several years before Jean turned 18. And his presentation solidified for me that supported decision-making was a great alternative to a court-ordered guardianship that we know some of her older peers and classmates have. Our parenting decisions and expectations have always been for Jean to become an independent adult, and Jean has grown up with her own expectations of living as independent life as possible. Like all young adults, Jean is growing and developing her own decision-making skills. We are right-sizing our supports, giving her the freedom and choice to live her life. As Jean's supporters, we help her make crucial decisions, and we have a process to do that. The way it works is when a decision comes up, Jean either decides on her own or she goes over the issue with us. We review information and choices together and discuss options and consequences of her different choices. We're not her guardians, as she does not need someone else to determine how to live her life. In addition, I have also been utilizing supported decision-making principles to support my 89-year-old mother, Joanne. My siblings and I have helped her through a number of complicated health issues, including her most recent struggle with mixed dementia. As her memory loss has progressed, we have increased our support and assistance with decision making. We strive to respect her wishes, helping her age with dignity, retaining a balance of safety and autonomy, and preparing for the next phase of her life without removing her civil rights through a guardianship. Not only are we her children, we are her advocates. No matter a person's stage in life, whether their capacity is growing or diminishing, they should have access to individualized natural supports that help them live with dignity, autonomy, and self-determination. That is why we strongly support the many changes proposed in House File 3391 and hope you will as well.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Hoff. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Jean Hoff. Thank you for the chance to provide my testimony. President-centered planning has helped me with my goals and life plans. I am making my own decision to go to college, have a career, and live independently. Just before my 18th birthday, my parents and I talked about the need to have legal documents in place. Since I was going to become an adult, they helped me find a lawyer. I meet with John Kaki at VOA. I was comfortable with him as my lawyer. We worked together to create my legal documents, a healthcare directive and power of attorney with special protection and support decision-making agreement. John reviewed my documents with me before I signed them. My parents were at the meeting as my supporters. The process was not hard or scary. I felt empowered. I did not have to go to court. A judge has not taken away my right to make decisions about my life. I do need some support making healthcare decisions. My mom goes to my appointments with me, helps me ask questions and make decisions. I have had same doctors my whole life, so I have good doctors, patients, and relationships. I am learning to do my budget and baking. My mom is putting me as a nurse and takes one more responsibility. Thank you for this opportunity, as I think everyone is a chance to set up decision making for their own life.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Hoff. An excellent job. Very nice. Are there questions from members of the committee for, well, actually I should ask, do we have another testifier first? Oh, two more testifiers. Well, let's hold off on questions then until we get through the other testifiers. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Sean Burke. I'm the Public Policy Director with the Minnesota Elder Justice Center. As Representative Moeller said in her remarks, this bill represents nearly 2 years' worth of collaborative stakeholder involvement, a process that was really spearheaded by Bob McLeod here to my left. Our organization often works with vulnerable and older adults for whom guardianship is not working or it's not a good option in the first place. Without Bob's efforts and the cooperation and agreement with the large stakeholder, with all the stakeholders, it's doubtful that we would have this significant piece of legislation. Together, Bob and I are going to highlight the key changes to guardianship and conservatorship law in the DE amendment. We'll do our best to direct you to the section and the line number. So starting in section one, at line 1.10, you will notice that currently Minnesota law does not allow judges to order mediation in guardianship cases But in many situations, mediation can be a critical tool to resolving disputes in guardianship litigation, especially when there is a dispute as to whether guardianship should even exist or who should be the guardian. This change would allow courts to order parties to mediate. Sections 2 through 9 include new definitions that will help clarify critical parts of guardianship cases and proceedings. At the heart of every guardianship case, a court must make 2 findings in order to order a guardianship. It must do so by clear and convincing evidence. The first is it must find that the person is incapacitated. The second is that it must find that there are no less restrictive alternatives. The definition in Section 3 at line 1.17 modernizes the definition of incapacitated person to include a less restrictive analysis. And this is because capacity for purposes of guardianship is different than, say, informed consent for a medical procedure. And before removing a person's civil rights, a court must be sure that no less restrictive alternatives exist. The addition on line 1.22 will help ensure that that happens. Moving to section 9, line 3.22, you will see for the first time in Minnesota law, we will have a definition of supported decision making, a specific type of less restrictive alternative. Earlier, you heard the testimony from Jean and others who've established a supported decision-making agreement and has supports in place to help her. The language in this definition comes specifically from the Uniform Law Commission and their model guardianship statute in 2017. It provides a broad understanding of supported decision-making so that a wide array of supported decision-making agreements, including those that you heard about in Eric and Jean's testimony, will be recognized by this definition. Turning now to section 13, starting on line 7.11. This is the Bill of Rights for persons under guardianship. For many guardians and people under guardianship, one of the most difficult situations that can arise is a disagreement about who the person under guardianship can communicate with or interact with. Currently, under Minnesota law, guardians have a wide leeway and latitude to restrict the rights of persons under guardianship from speaking, calling, texting, or otherwise communicating with other persons. This important change, which is also modeled after the Uniform Law Commission provisions, instructs guardians to only restrict those communications when, one, there is a risk of significant harm, and two, there are no other alternatives to prevent the risk. Additionally, the guardian must notify the court, the person under guardianship, and the person from whom the person under guardianship is being restricted. The person under guardianship can then petition to have the court modify or lift the restriction.
Mr. Chair and members.
Before you begin, Mr. McLeod, Mr. Burke, can you tell me how often do you run into scenarios where mediation should be ordered, but judges just don't do it?
Mr. Chair, again, my name is Robert McLeod, Bess and Flanagan. Most cases, most contested cases. Now, the simple fact is by statute, they can't order mediation. And that's why we're changing the statute. They are not allowed to. Although Hennepin County.
The statute specifically prohibits that.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. Starting in section 14, line 8.1 and through the rest of page 8 is a new section called the Bill of Particulars. The purpose of this addition is to better protect the privacy rights of persons for whom a guardianship is being considered. When a petitioner begins a guardianship case, as Sean said, they must prove incapacity. That means proving that the case often involves medical information and medical records about a person's diagnosis and oftentimes intimate and private details about their everyday needs. While parties can request to file such document confidentially, the reality is not all courts allow such requests. And in fact, if you look at the court website, it says you can't. This section establishes a new process called the Bill of Particulars, a form that the parties attach medical records and other private data and file it confidentially. In addition to this new section of the law, throughout the bill is additional language that directs parties or others filing information with the court exactly when to use this process. One example is on line 9.18, which indicates what type of documents need to be filed confidentially, consistently with the Bill of Particulars procedure. This language is repeated throughout the bill to clarify when certain documents in guardianship conservatorship process need to be filed in a way to protect privacy. This change is critical in protecting private information, especially as we near the day when Minnesota court files records. The records will be filed publicly with just a click. You can just sign on and click and see everyone's pleadings right there on the internet.
Moving ahead to Section 17 and Section 20. Starting on line 11.
Go ahead, Mr. Burke.
Nope, sorry. Starting on line 11.27, petitioners bringing a case alleging guardianship is necessary will need to describe any less restrictive alternatives that have been attempted. This is right in line with the second prong of finding a guardianship. And it corresponds with Section 20 on line 16.6. Whereby after the petition and the litigation, a court in making a finding in order to place a person under guardianship will now need to make specific findings as to why supported decision making or other alternatives do not work. Staying on page 16 at lines 16.20 to 16.26, this bill introduces a new tool to help reduce unnecessary guardianships. If a person is under the age of 30 when a guardianship is established, that guardianship will end after 6 years. A new petition can be filed at that time if it is still alleged that the person is incapacitated and no less restrictive alternatives will work. We know that too often families of young adults are directed to use guardianship as the only legal mechanism to protect a young adult. The testimony you heard earlier belies that notion. We also know that critical development happens for all persons, especially those with intellectual and developmental disabilities, in their young and mid-20s. This mechanism simply allows the system to pause and really examine if a guardianship is needed.
Again, Robert
McLeod.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, Robert McLeod. In Section 21, starting at line 17.32, there's an important clarifying change to the emergency guardianship process. Too often in Minnesota, the emergency guardianship is not being used for its intended purpose. An emergency guardianship is a proceeding that lacks sufficient due process for the person who is alleged to need a guardian. It is designed for extreme cases only. Unfortunately, many courts overuse the tool and allow for multiple extensions of the emergency guardianship. The result is that a person can wait months on end, sometimes longer, without receiving the full due process protections of a full guardianship hearing. This language clarifies that emergency guardianships can only be extended one time so that the total maximum time anyone under an emergency guardianship order lasts 120 days.
In Section 23,
Mr. Burke,
starting on line 24.4, there's an important clarification to help ensure that families and other interested persons are informed about significant events in the life of a person under guardianship. Guardians must file an annual well-being report with the court, but what happens if the person under guardianship is hospitalized for a heart attack and needs to be hospitalized for several days? Currently, there's nothing in the law obligating guardians to inform family members or other interested persons, and there are many examples where loved ones simply don't know that a person under guardianship has had a significant adverse health event. So the changes in this section lay out three specific situations in which a guardian must inform interested persons about the event unless they are otherwise prevented from a court order. These include a sudden or unexpected change in a health condition, a significant situation requiring the involvement of law enforcement or emergency personnel, or, of course, if the person under guardianship passes away.
Mr. McLeod.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Section 24, line 25.28, is language that clarifies a court-appointed guardian or conservator can petition the court to be discharged from that appointment. This is not the same thing as being removed by the court. This simple provision allows guardians who have faithfully executed all their obligations to request the court to discharge them from the guardianship responsibilities. This is an important due process protection for the guardian and conservator, him or herself, as there have been examples of when people served as guardian and never got discharged, and they're still under court supervision and they've been done for years. So it's just a clarifying thing that we can wrap things up and close the file.
And Mr. Chair, last one. Sections 25 through 37 of the bill make a lot of similar changes to the conservatorship statutes. Conservatorships are put in place when a person cannot make financial decisions for him or herself. So, for example, the same less restrictive alternatives language is inserted for petitions and for court orders. The same language that Bob pointed out about the filing of documents consistent with a bill of particulars is added. And in section 39, we now would allow conservators to petition for a restraining order in the instance that we so often see these days of financial exploitation or other predators trying to take advantage of people under conservatorship. Obviously, there are several other sections that we did not go over, all of which are either updating or clarifying current law. We're happy to speak to any of those as we stand for questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Burke. Are there any other testifiers you have, Representative Muller?
No.
Okay. We will move to questions, but is there anyone else from the audience or the public who wishes to be heard on House File 3391? Can we amend this as amended? I see no hands. Okay, questions. Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just one quick question to the bill's author. Well, perhaps to your testifiers that are at the table right now. You mentioned the time limitedness of this guardianship being 6 years, and I'm just wondering how you arrived at that number and if any opposition exists out there right now for that provision.
Okay, Mr. Burke.
Mr. Chair, Chair Scott, thank you for that question. You did pinpoint an area that was a robust area of discussion for all of the stakeholders. Some individuals wanted it a longer time frame. Others wanted it much shorter. And the 72 months really, if you work backwards from if an individual gets guardianship at the age of 18, then after 6 years at the age of 24, it would be examined again. And then one more time potentially after that. That really creates two pauses in their life from ages 18 to 30, 12 years in which we know, think about how your life changes in that. Everyone settled upon that as what we thought was a reasonable way to, again, stop unnecessary guardianships without creating too much of a burden for other individuals. I would say we as a coalition have not heard anyone specifically pushing back and demanded that be changed. The discussion has always been robust and one where an understanding that there's trade-offs for both sides and this is a reasonable compromise.
Thank you, Chair Scott. Chair Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What?
Sir, go ahead. I skipped over Albright, but we'll get to him eventually.
Okay, thank you. Actually, my question is for Jean or her mother. First, I'm really pleased that this is working out, and Jean, as the chair said, you did a really nice job testifying. I'm curious, as Jean is working towards independence, do you utilize home health aides, personal care attendants? Is that part of the plan right now for her to be independent?
Thank you, Chair and member. No, right now she all her supports are natural. Through her transition, she still is attending a school, and then just through family.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for coming back and answering the question. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this would be to either the testifiers, but I'm looking at the section 16, subdivision 16A, it refers back to subdivision 7 under interested person. And I'm keying on 3.25, which says supported decision making means assistance from one or more persons of an individual's choosing. And the definitions on page 2 with regard to the people that would be applicable to that. And my first question is, once the individuals are chosen, are they identified to anyone so that no one can kind of say, well, I'm a person of interest, so I have an opportunity. So what I'm trying to say is, does the individual subject to guardianship choose and then that's it, or does that list change from time to time?
Mr. Burke.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, it's a good question. Stepping back a half step, I do think it's important to distinguish between the definition at 3.24 of supported decision making and the definition of interested persons, which is already in the statute. Those are two very separate things. So when you're looking at line 3.25 in a supported decision making arrangement, think of that as its own universe. And in fact, what Gene or Eric or others did is they went to an attorney and talked about, just like you would in a healthcare directive or a power of attorney, who are the people that you trust to help you make decisions? And that's where that conversation of those people comes into play. So I haven't seen Gene's documents, but a typical supported decision-making agreement that's attached to a healthcare directive will explain to who's ever looking at the healthcare directive, this person, you know, has so-and-so diagnosis. This is who they've chosen to help them make decisions. They are not under guardianship. This is a valid healthcare directive. And then you can use that to go get healthcare and treatment. That's already happening in the world, and the desire of this definition was simply to capture the universe of those types of arrangements. That whole process is separate from interested persons, which is a very defined set of people in the statute, so that in the guardianship process, there is a due process laid out there, and people who may be interested in the case are essentially given notice and saying this is happening. So I would really separate those two concepts.
Representative Albright?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's very, very helpful. So then to my question, because you've clarified it, is then will the people involved in that supported decision-making process, can they change over time?
Mr. Burke.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, sure, of course. And in fact, one of the most exciting things for advocates in this space is to watch what happens over the next 15, 20, 30 years, just as all of us change who our support networks are. They go from our family, our friends, our brother and sister, to eventually potentially our partner and spouse and others. The same type of thing can happen as a person under a supported decision-making arrangement changes as well. And they have the cognitive ability and the capacity legally to go back and change those.
Thank
yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One final question. And I'm going to follow up on Chair Scott's question on page 16 with regard to the threshold for the 30-year-old and the 72 months. So let's say that guardianship was enacted at age 24, and let's say the individual is now 26 or 27, and they have had a market improvement or change in their situation. Is there an appeal process existent in law or in this that would avail that person to remove guardianship from the situation?
Mr. McLeod.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Albright. The answer is yes. At any time, any person under guardianship can petition to have the guardianship modified, to have the powers changed, or to have the guardianship terminated altogether. And on an annual basis, people who are under guardianship are given a notice that they have the right to do this. And in fact, under these statutory changes, we're expanding those notices of rights. So each year, a person under guardianship is given notice of rights, and part of those rights is the ability to petition to terminate the guardianship or to change the powers or modify it or change the guardian. All of that is always on the table at all times.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a couple questions. First, regarding the interested persons definitions, aside from the requirement that these people are communicated with, is there any other sort of rights that they have? I'm particularly interested in why the stepchildren were involved. I know that can be very contentious, and so I'm interested how that will play out. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Robbins. Interested persons, the focal point of a guardianship proceeding is to make sure the court is fully informed. An interested persons is distinguishable from interested parties. An interested party as a point of law is someone who has a vested interest or stake in the outcome of the proceedings. An interested person is someone who's given notice and otherwise allowed to participate in the proceedings, not because they per se have specific rights, but because they may have information that may be very helpful to the proceedings. And as such, sometimes those interested persons are clipped from the proceedings, not allowed to pursue any further or otherwise. Now, they might have other rights under other law, but the point is they're given notices because they can offer input and provide input. Adding stepchildren is the hard part in this proceeding is it's just not safe to assume that who an adverse person is. Very often the stepchildren are the closest people they have in their whole lives. Very often they've been raising the stepchildren as their own children, and they're as much of a parent to that person as anyone in the world. And they wake up to find themselves not getting notice of a proceeding when this person is more dear to them than anyone else. So it's sometimes with some weird notions, we sometimes feel like some people are adverse when they aren't. There's always opportunity for someone to object and to be adverse to each other. But in a court proceeding, that is managed. And also, once the spouse dies, however, the stepchildren element ends. So if they're no longer a stepchild, if they're no longer married.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And also a second question regarding the 6-year term between people who are 18 and 30. I understand and sympathetic about why that's important for people. But for people who their capacity will not change, does the family, so I know families in this situation, and do they have to go and re-petition for full guardianship at 24 years and 30 years? Because that's a very involved process. And it seems for families where there's clear incapacitation, that's a significant burden for them to have to go through that again two more times.
Mr. Chair, Representative Robbins, it is a very good question, and it speaks to the conversation I was having with Chair Scott as well. A couple of points to be made. First of all, it's not just that they have to prove incapacity. Remember, there's two elements of a guardianship case. They also have to prove that no less restrictive alternatives work. And if anything, supportive decision making and its development over the past 15, 20 years has showed us that this alternative way to make decisions and have legal decision makers help you out has been an amazing asset for a lot of young people and older people as well. And so what this process is really doing is not just looking at capacity, but it's also really forcing our entire system to look at those alternatives, something that's already in our statute. So that's one. Number two, in those many of us think those cases will be more rare when it's really obvious, because the difference, again, between an 18-year-old and a 30-year-old, even people with significant disabilities, can be drastic. And so in those cases where it is more obvious, the family, having done the petition once, will have already now gone through it a couple of times. And so a lot of their work, their paperwork, the filing, it's potentially not going to change a whole lot. And so, again, taken all together, the cost-benefit analysis and the burden, while there in some cases, is going to be greatly outweighed by that pausing and second look to make sure that no less restrictive alternatives exist.
Any other questions from members of the committee? Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Mueller, thank you for working on this. And just one question, forgive me if I missed this, but have counties been involved in this process at all, and do they maybe not need to be? And just, you know, things, just, I've been well trained by my county to always ask that question.
Mr. McLeod.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, the court system, was kept informed throughout the system, and they've had representatives who've been a part of the system or part of the process, and we've provided them the information on an ongoing basis. And to my knowledge, they've offered no objection, to my knowledge. So we've been keeping them informed, but to my knowledge, we have no objection from them.
Mr. Burke?
Mr. Chair, Chair Liebling, the other thing to just kind of briefly note is counties can be petitioners. They sometimes are, especially in difficult, vulnerable adult cases where an individual is being abused and they may use guardianship actually as a protective proceeding. But again, as Bob just mentioned, no objections, and also them going through, they would go through the petitioner process just like anyone would if you're a petitioner.
Chair Liebling.
Well, thank you. And so no objections, but have they been affirmatively involved? Have they been affirmatively informed? I mean, I know they do track things, but, you know, this is these are pretty big changes.
Mr. McLeod?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I guess the counties per se, no, but the courts, yes. It was a large group, but I don't think we had anyone who was per se from a representative county attorney's office of some sort or other. I don't recall anyone of that sort.
Thank you. Chair Liebling? Is it okay? Well, this is going to Ways and Means.
Chair.
And
sorry.
Got another answer coming.
I see it coming. Okay. I'm tracking here. It's going to Ways and Means, and you sit on Ways and Means. So between now and then, maybe they can have a affirmative answer on county. Mr. Burke? Okay. All right. Any other comments or questions? Then Chair Mahler moves that House File 3391 as amended be recommended to be re-referred to Ways and Means. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. The bill as amended is re-referred to Ways and Means.
Thank you.
There is no other official business before the committee. I guess we've got Representative Moran on tomorrow, Minnesota Human Rights Act, and then Human Services Child Welfare, and Representative Claflin, non-woven disposable product labeling. But before that, normally we get a notice from the sergeant when they have assigned us our pages. And we have two committee pages now. One just left. But it's our custom to introduce the committee pages. We went around and introduced all the committee members and staff, but by that point our committee pages were not officially assigned, so we have Gabby and Brenna. Gabby is here, so Gabby and Brenna, so we'll see. And sorry, you're Gabby.
Yes.
Brenna. Okay, so we'll see Brenna when she comes back, but thank you, welcome to the committee, and everyone will treat you well. Or you come talk to me, okay? All right, thank you. There being no other business before the committee is adjourned.